Phantasm. Is it a nightmare? Phantasm. Is it an illusion? Phantasm. Is it an evil? Phantasm. Is it a fantasy? Phantasm. Is it alive? If this one doesn't scare you, you're already dead.
Welcome back to the Bitter End Podcast, Season 10, with me, Todd Jordan.
And me, Ten Denny. I mean, Tom Denny.
Oh my God, we are tens all up the wazoo.
Tens across the board, baby! We've made it.
Ten seasons seems like a lot of seasons. That's more seasons than, oh, I don't know, Game of Thrones.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I haven't watched it.
We got around that problem of people not liking the ending by just not writing an ending.
Yeah,
we'll just keep it going.
Happen. We'll have the problem of just keep on going and no one liking it like The Simpsons instead.
Oh, I'm sad now.
Yeah, sorry.
And we are here to talk about an excellent, tidy, little, very overlooked franchise called Phantasm.
Overlooked is right because, I don't know.
Well, it is something, especially as a horror fan and as a young emerging horror fan, when I was dipping my toe back into horror about 55 years ago, I was very aware of this franchise. It kind of loomed large. And the fact that it was quite hard to come by made it a bit more illicit.
Yes.
Now, I have seen Phantasm number one from 1979 a very, very long time ago. There used to be a thing, right, when I was a kid on the Sci-Fi channel.
Ah, yeah.
Called Sci-Fright.
Ooh.
Which basically meant that they played a horror film at 10 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to stay up on a weeknight after my parents had gone to bed, and I would just watch whatever old shit
happened
to be the Sci-Fright movie of the night.
And I bet there was a lot of old shit.
I saw a lot of old shit, but I saw a lot of really weird films that I genuinely just think I've dreamt.
Okay.
Like now,
yeah.
With all kinds of really weird stuff and like forgotten old things. And the one that I remember the strongest amongst it all was when they screened Phantasm. It's really unusual. If it's anything like how I remember it, it's an unusual hybrid beast.
Well, I'm all in for going on this crazy ride, and we watched the trailer of it to get a little bit of a taste. The original like 1979 trailer, not like a modern recutting, and you can tell because it's like, you know, we talk about 70s pacing, it's like 2 minutes long. I mean, they could definitely like cut that shit down. But I totally see what you say about it, like, you know, be like, did I dream that? Because it is a collection of just unrelated images next to each other, some weird, you know, dream-like shit. There's some, like Nightmare on Elm Street kind of vibes going on there. There's a bit where a guy kind of goes into, like a drawer and seems to appear in Dune, and then someone grabs him by the butt and pulls him back in. That's kind of odd. I'm looking forward to seeing what happens there.
Yeah, it's got a real kind of labyrinth meets horror vibe.
Yeah. Very surreal kind of shit going on.
Yeah.
So I'm into mixed with like a handsome leading man who seems just like completely like blasé about everything, because I'm just getting the impression that he's not going to be a very good actor, because all this weird shit's going on. He's just like, oh yeah.
Well, this was a real, real independent movie. It's made by a guy called Don Coscarelli.
Mm.
If listeners don't know Phantasm, they might know a couple of his other more popular films from recent times. He made John Dies at the End, which is a bit of a cult hit. And he also made a really cool film with Bruce Campbell called Bubba Hotep.
I've not seen it, but I heard tell of it.
I like Bubba Hotep, and I think that might be his biggest budget film.
Right.
But really, most of his career is very much dedicated to Phantasm. He also did a movie called The Beastmaster, which I hear a lot of people like.
It's a good name, if nothing else.
And just to be clear, the franchise in question takes in Phantasm from 1979, which we're starting this time. Next time, we will be watching Phantasm 2 from 1988. So that is a nine-year gap.
Yeah.
Then Phantasm 3, Lord of the Dead from 1994. Again, six-year gap.
Mm.
Phantasm 4 Oblivion, 1998, shorter gap, down to just 4 years.
Good.
And then Phantasm 5 Ravager from 2016.
got to keep pumping out those phantasms every whenever, however many years. And also, crucially with this, like, what makes it different from other things that we've done on the Bitter End or from just most franchises in general, is that it is the same core creative team across all films.
Absolutely. Don Coscarelli himself directs all but one of them. The very last one is directed by a man called David Hartman, but Coscarelli wrote the script still and produced it still. And the main lead villain, Angus Scrimm, is the actor's name. He is involved. He's deceased now, I believe, RIP, the big Scrimster. But he is in all of them as well. And I think even the hero, who starts as a young boy, grows up as it goes on. Although that remains to be seen, because I've only seen the first one.
Well, time will tell. But I think we should get cracking on this, like, you know, crazy labyrinth ride. But Todd, do we have some business to take care of first?
We do, Tom. And if this doesn't scare you, you're already dead.
Hooray!
That's the tagline from the trailer. It's a pretty good tagline, I thought. Tom, we need to play that IMDb guessing game.
Damn right we do.
Now, this is the game where we look to the users of IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, to see what they reckon of the film we're about to watch. Now, Tom, I've seen Phantasm. I know what I think of it.
Yep.
You haven't. What do you think everyone else thinks of it? Phantasm from 1979, Don Coscarelli's indie renegade masterpiece.
Well, you know, from the trailer, there's some wacky business going on there. Like, it looks pretty cool. It's, like, from the 70s, which makes, I don't know, like, kind of like a, I don't know, like, it's a different age of horror, more of a golden age than, like, the 80s. Maybe I get the feeling that people might be kind of digging on this shit. It's not going to have as big an audience. People are going to be liking it. I know horror films don't usually rate very high on IMDb.
That's true.
So, do I go above a 7? Because horror films don't go above 7s, do they? I'm going to say 7.
Well, Tom, you're pretty goddamn close. It is a 6.8, which is very high for one of these horror films, I think.
Yeah.
For a 40-odd year... Oh, wait, hang on. 79, 89, 99, 2009, 2019. It's 40 years.
Well, I mean, Bully, I think we're going to have a lovely time. I hope we are.
Yeah. And
if you don't, you're already dead. Okay, straight off the bat, I'm in. I'm in on this fucking thing.
Oh, it's a heady brew.
Whoa. Oh, it's the spicy meatball, folks.
Oh, God, I'm so pleased. Because listeners at home, me and Tom have a thing where we try not to talk about the movies until we're on the poddy. So the movie came to an end, the credits rolled, and we were slightly tight-lipped. We were a bit like, but we still had to kind of set the microphone up, and we had to get the laptop running and take our places, and we were, there was a little bit of awkward tension between us. You know, we were trying to avoid the
didn't know which way it was going to go.
And we just started rolling, and oh, I'm so relieved.
Digging it, yeah. I mean, there's things in this. It's a film with things, people. And, like, my first thought is, like, so there was, like, 9 movies between this and the next one.
9 years.
Nine movies.
I wish there were 9 more movies.
Yeah, sorry. I'm a sleepy boy. Anyway, so there's this big gap between this and the next film. And in my head, I'm like, well, it's not going to be very long until me and Todd watch the next one. So I can maybe get some answers to some of the batshit crazy fucking stuff that was going on in this film. I would be so frustrated if I saw this in 1979, because instantly I'm just like, but what about this? But what about this? What the fuck was that all about? And this thing and that guy and who now? It's so, while we're watching the film, we realised that apparently the film, it's like a lean 90 minutes.
Yeah.
It's the kind of film
it's
like.
Tight.
It's perfect. Was edited down from an original 3-hour runtime. And when you know that, you go like, yep, okay, yeah, I can see that. I can see.
There's big reels missing. Yeah. And then it also feels like they must have only gotten one take of some quite key scenes, because there's some scenes just really go on at like a luxurious pace of just like characters sitting around doing nothing. Oh, because there's one tiny bit of it that must be included later.
Yes, yes. Yeah, you're kind of like, did we need to leave that in? Oh, yes, apparently we did. And stuff like, there's like an obvious scene in there, which we'll come to, I'm sure, where it's kind of like, and that seems like that was like a pickup shot where it's kind of like, well, we've edited out basically a massive chunk of the film and we're just going to have somebody pop up and just say all this stuff that happened off camera so we don't have to, you know, we don't have to waste any time. But anyway...
First things first, before we get into the plot, I will just say, if you're a horror fan, not seen Phantasm, check it out, guys, because come on.
Yeah, and also, I'm going to say, if you're someone who likes horror movie soundtracks, fuck me, the music in this film is absolutely banging. One of, like, the star performances of this film is whoever that guy was doing the soundtrack.
It was Fred Myro and Malcolm Seagrave, I believe. Never heard of them before. It's great.
Yeah, really, like, strong. So, Mr. Jordan, the film doth begin in a spooky graveyard.
Spooky graveyard.
The way I like my graveyards.
Yep, it's nighttime, we got some great music, and there's some a young 70s couple, possibly the most 70s couple I have ever seen.
Big handlebar moustache on the dude, of indiscriminate age, could be 12, could be 55, he's got a handlebar moustache, who knows?
And he is with a lady that is way out of his league.
Yeah.
And he's lying on his back doing absolutely nothing.
He's practically asleep.
He's like completely motionless. His eyes are almost closed. He's just sort of lying there, almost, he's maybe making a snoring sound.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, yeah, come on. I love the way you do it.
And he's like, yeah, baby, that feels so good. I'm going to just take a little sleepy now. Oh, that feels so good. Neither of these people are moving. It's the most anaerobic sex I've ever seen on film. But he's getting off on it.
He's getting off on it. But then we cut to her chest. She's got her breasts out, one of them covered with her hand, but the other one is out. And then she's holding a knife and then she stabs him dead. And then she turns into an old man.
And then I'm like, well, I'm interested. Okay.
It's a bold start to a movie.
Yep, and then we go to this fella's funeral.
His name was Tommy.
He was Tommy.
He's getting buried at a place called Morningside, which is where most of this film takes place, Morningside Cemetery. And his mates Reggie and Jody are there for the funeral.
Reggie is an ice cream man who looks like the bald one with a ponytail from Status Quo. And then Jody is kind of... So you know how in Jaws 3... who is the bootleg Harrison Ford in Jaws 3?
Oh, I don't know. One of the Brody kids.
Yeah, one of the Brody kids. Dennis Quaid.
Quaid.
So this guy's like a bootleg Dennis Quaid. He's all bell-bottoms and 70s hair. They're burying their mate Tommy. And then we also get Michael, who is Jody's brother. He's 13, he's just like fucking rocking that double denim like nobody's business, and he's riding a motorcycle over all the graves in a massive bit of disrespect to the dead.
Well, because Michael has been told by his older brother Jody he's not allowed to come to the funeral because 2 years ago Michael and Jody lost their parents. Oh no, they passed away. And ever since then, Michael has had nonstop nightmares about death. He's obsessed with death. He's fascinated by it. He's terrified by it. And so Jody's trying to keep him away from the funeral, but Michael isn't having none of it. He sneaks in.
And he seems to also just follow Jody around. The whole thing through the film is that Jody's like, oh, my little brother's always following me around. I think because he's like afraid that he's going to lose the one bit of family he's got left. Also, just doesn't seem there's a lot to do in this town. Just like, follow my older brother around. We'll see what happens. And so he's spying on the funeral. We get this whole cool bit of Jody walking through kind of, I guess, is it like
it's the mausoleum.
The mausoleum, which is all like fake marble walls. The set is really cool. It's like really cool, but really fake at the same time. The Foley guy is working super hard with all these super echoey footsteps, just like, loving that. And then the tall man, the villain of the piece, pops up behind him after he's walking around. He keeps on hearing some weird noise. He doesn't see what the noise was. Tall man pops up. He's like, the funeral is beginning, sir.
He's so sick. He's super tall. He's got like this massive jaw that's like bigger than one of my thighs.
He's kind of a bit of a lurch character, isn't he? Yeah, he's got that. He's given off that kind of vibe. And then like the funeral's done. But Michael is out spying on the funeral with binoculars. Like he's on some sort of like military training. And he, when everyone's gone, he sees the tall man just go and get the coffin, and he just like whoop, picks it up under one arm, hoofs it in the back of the hearse, and off he goes. He's like, well, that's not right, because like coffins are like heavy and shit. Intrigue, mystery.
Now, I still now don't know quite what the implication of that is, because knowing what we know when we see the whole film, does that mean the coffin's empty? Which could be a thing.
No.
Does that mean that the tall man is super strong?
The tall man is super strong because later on in the film, when Michael tells this to Jodie, Jodie's like, but he was one of the pallbearers. He like helped take the coffin. You see a scene where him and Ice Cream Man take the coffin out of the car, and they're like, oh, it was like super heavy. Like,
okay.
It was like, you know, it was like a coffin with a body in it and shit.
So it's okay.
The tall man is, there's something ooky about him.
Yes, he's very ooky and he's kooky. He's really rather spooky.
Yes. So then, like, okay, there's a bunch of stuff that's going to happen now. Not all of this might actually really be of any consequence at all. Michael is then going to go and see some gal he knows and her spooky grandma.
Yep, and they've both got these star-shaped tattoos on their faces.
And she's kind of do kind of a psychic reading, and then magically a box is going to appear in the middle of a table, and later the box will magically disappear, and Michael's kind of like, huh, bit weird, but whatever. Magically appearing box, not that fussed.
He's cool with it. He has to put his hand in the box. It's terribly painful. It's exactly like that bit from Dune. Exactly.
Yes.
Fear is the mind killer. It says in Dune, Carl McLachlan has to put his hand in the box. He's like, the pain! And they say, fear is the mind killer. Don't take your hand out of the box and everything's fine. This scene, totally different. Box magically appears. He has to put his hand in it. It really hurts. And they say, fear is the killer. It's a totally different line.
It's totally different. These are unrelated things, Todd. I don't know why you're even bringing it up. Okay, so that scene happens. We never see that girl or the spooky grandma again. We don't know what their fucking deal is. Why Michael like goes over to visit this like young girl and her spooky grandma?
It's because of a very important lesson that he has to learn later on about being brave.
You know why? I think the answer might be in an hour and a half's worth of lost footage, because it just like, it's like, just felt like it was like, oh, well, this is going to be a fucking thing. These people, we're going to go back to spooky, like, star-faced grandma, and she's going to explain some more stuff to him along the way. Maybe she knows what's going on with the tall man. Don't know. It was just a really nice Dune reference.
Yeah, really sick Dune reference.
Yeah. Speaking of Dune references.
Yeah, Jodie is so mental. Like, I'm sure there's, if we Google it, there'll be reasons for all of this written around. Maybe Don Coscarelli was just reading Dune at the time.
Yeah.
But Jodie, the older brother, then goes to a bar called Dune's Bar. and he picks up, dun, 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 the boobs girl from the start of the movie.
The boobs girl from the start of the movie. And Michael has gone and followed him because that's what Michael likes to do. He goes and follows his brother. We don't hear what he says to the girl, but man, that is a lickety split quick up. Lickety split pick up.
Pick up.
He goes up. Mumble, mumble, mumble. They're off to the graveyard to bone the fuck down.
Yeah, and like even at the time, they're walking through this graveyard at night, like straight from the bar, and Jodie's like, it's a bit spooky, isn't it? And she goes, No, I think it's sexy.
Yeah, lovely.
And so Michael's like perving on him, looking through his binoculars, and the girl takes her top off and her breasts are there, and there's this like classic classy line where like the kid is literally like, wow,
amazing. It's, I mean, and it also just reminded me of something we've just watched, Jaws 3D, another scene where family just go and watch family fuck down. It's I mean, it's weird, people. Is it just me? Is this weird? I feel it's weird. But while he's watching his brother fuck down and saying wow at some boobs, Michael hears something. There's something in the bushes. Sounds like a bear. And it's not his brother getting his boink on, I can tell you that. He has a bit of a look around, he's not sure. And then suddenly, a dressing gown comes running out of the bush at him, going... And he fucking pelts it across the graveyard, past his brother, and like...
And what's his brother doing, Tom?
He's got a pants in his mouth, and he just turns around with a pair of knickers hanging out of his mouth, going, "What the hell?"
It's so funny.
And then he runs, and then he turns to the girl who's like lying underneath him, like, "It's my kid brother." He's still got pants in his mouth, and then he runs off after him, going, "Michael, Michael," while he's got pants in his mouth. And, like, it's very weird, but this film actually, like, you know, it's got some cool, spooky, very weird, surreal horror shit, but it's actually also got, like, this very cool, dry, weird sense of humour. Like, there are funny bits, and it's not just, like, funny bits that are meant to be, that aren't meant to be funny. It's just, like, it's a bad film. Like, it's funny. Like,
it's super funny. And, like, yeah, that's not an accidental bit of, like, awesome underpants-based hilarity. Like, that's just some underpants-based hilarity, people.
Pure and simple. Pure and simple. Just enjoy it. Watch the film, enjoy it.
And, yeah, they have this sort of bit of a heart-to-heart. And, again, so, you know, Michael's like, you're gonna leave me, you're gonna leave me. And Jodie's like, meh, 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 you need to go home. You know, it's all fine, I'm not gonna leave, but you need to go home. I gotta go look after this girl.
She fucks off.
Yeah, he goes back and she's gone. I can only assume without her knickers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and also he's like, oh, damn, she left. Like, well, you just went, like, charging off into the wilderness with her pants in your mouth after going, like, it's my brother! Like, you know, that's a mood killer.
Yeah, it's
a deal breaker for me.
I do get the impression that Jodie is meant to be, like, quite the catch, especially in this small town, because there is a scene we skirted over earlier on where he's on his porch and he's, like, rocking to himself on an electric guitar.
Yeah, and then the ice cream man comes and joins him.
Reggie the ice cream man, his best mate in the world with the sick ponytail and the leather waistcoat, turns up out of his ice cream van and he also gets out a guitar and they have a bit of a jam.
Yeah, and you're kind of like, huh, hour and 30 cut from this film, but this stayed in. Interesting.
And
interesting.
It's a very important scene. Very, it later turns
out to be very important later on. Or, I mean, is it? Like, it relates to something, but those two things don't necessarily relate.
No.
It's just some stuff that happens. But then, yeah, Michael, he goes to bed. He's, like, trying not to dream about his brother in pants. Instead, he has a spooky dream that he's in the graveyard. The tall man is looming over his bed. And then some bodies come jumping out of the ground to try and pull him in. That's cool. That's some spooky, like, proto-Elm Street stuff.
Yeah,
I'm
very
into
much
that.
So. I think I really saw that kind of Elm Street-y vibe. It does a good job of, like, blurring the line between, like, dreams and the waking world. And
yeah, yeah. And now, like, he's being haunted by the tall man wherever he goes. This is an amazing scene. The music is fantastic. It runs the line between, like, really spooky and also kind of cute and, like, very light and fluffy while you've got the tall man walking slow-mo down the street. The Foley Shoe Man is doing it again. Boom, boom, boom. And then you've got Reggie the ice cream man. He's, like, opening up the back of the ice cream van. There's all this smoke coming, not smoke, like, you know, like...
steam.
Like, steam. Yeah, like, it's, like, lots of, like, mist coming out.
Vapor.
Yeah, it's very sensual. There's a very sensual scene with this tall man. He stops in front of all the vapor and he turns in slow motion and he shakes his hair back like it's a Pantene advert. Other products are available. And he looks at Michael and just gives him the real stink eye. And it's kind of spooky, but also kind of like, tall man's giving him the come on.
It's so, like, I would describe it as sexy Boris Karloff.
Yeah, 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 definitely. Definitely sexy Boris Karloff. And then we got to move on. Some other weird shit has to happen in the film. We have no time to stop. Michael gets spooked out by some more renegade dressing gowns. These little, like, 3-foot little goblins in robes, like, pop up and try and crush him under a car because he's a mechanic.
Yeah, he's apparently, like, working on his car, and they like come up and pop it in the jack. And he's like, his brother comes and saves him from being crushed by the car. And he's like, what's going on? What's going on? He's like, oh, I'm being haunted by these little dwarf guys in dressing gowns. And it's because the tall man knows that I saw him carrying the very light coffin. And he's like, coming after me. It's because I saw something I shouldn't have seen.
Yes, yes, because he did get seen by the tall man at the funeral parlor at the beginning of the film. So then Michael's like, better take a big long knife and I'm going to go to the funeral parlor. I'm going to have a bit of a root around.
And this is where the shit really starts to hit the fan. So he's got his knife in his sock. He's got everything to prove. And he breaks into the funeral parlor, busts in a window, and he's already just really super creepy because it's late at night and he's just walking around with all these empty coffins. And there's this like other guy who's there who's like maybe like the night watchman or
he's got a hat or something. He looks a bit spooky.
And there's this really great bit where Michael has to hide from him inside a coffin. He's inside a coffin with the lid pulled down, like just open and only a tiny crack. And he's like looking out and the Hat Man's come in and the music's swelling and it's amazing. But then no, it's all right. The tall man comes, he calls Hat Man away. He's like, phew. So then Michael's like, all right, phew, that was a narrow escape. He walks out into the big marble mausoleum thing. And then, ruh-roh, what turns up? But the most iconic silver ball in horror history, which, by the way, guys, I would like to point out, if you purchase the Arrow Line Blu-ray edition of the Phantasm franchise, which I so happen to have, comes with a perfect replica of the iconic silver ball.
So, Todd, please explain the silver ball to our listeners who may not have seen Phantasm or understand what this thing is.
It's a silver ball. I would say it's about the size of a magic eight ball, if you know one of those. Mm-hmm. And it's got two pronged arrowheads jutting out of its front that look very sharp and very brutal. And yeah. In the film, it flies along doing the tall man's bidding at tremendous speed.
Yeah, just flies around unseenly controlled by the tall man, I guess. And yeah, like the hat guy lurks up behind Michael, grabs him, and they're scrapping away. And then Michael bites into his arm
so hard
that loads of like really cool kind of like 70s fake blood comes out. That's kind of like really like thick and gooey and just slightly the wrong red, which is pretty awesome. And he ducks down, and then the silver spiky ball goes ga-dunk right into Hat Man's face. And you're like, okay, pretty cool. But then you're like, oh, it hasn't really like embedded like deep into his head. It's kind of like hooked onto the side of his head so that then a drill can come out of the silver ball and go straight through the bridge of his nose and drill into his face, at which point blood starts shooting out of a hole in the other side of the ball. So it's like this kind of like weird ejaculating blood silver ball in the middle of this dude's face. And it's just going...
And it's like one of those little taps you're supposed to put in kegs to like keg. So like this guy got one of those like rammed into his skull. And now he's like kegging beer out, like, well, blood beer out of his face everywhere.
This scene is incredible. Yeah, and then he fucking like keels over, pisses himself. That is the capper. It's just like, not only did we just see this like bizarre like flying silver ball drill blood ejaculation death. Dude, weed himself.
The final insult.
Fair enough.
I mean, I would.
Yeah. I mean, at that point, like, well, what have I got to lose?
Yeah. Why? No sense standing on ceremony.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, well, half my face is already over the floor.
This scene is so unbelievably good. And it's really effective because the like brutality of it kind of comes out of nowhere.
Yeah, and you don't really see that kind of brutality again, really, in the film. Like, not to this level, but this is the bit where the film suddenly goes, okay, shit is happening now. Things are going to get weird.
Yeah, it like establishes this really like anarchic, like anything can actually happen vibe quite well.
Absolutely.
You know, because at first, well, I think probably when I was first watching this, I was like, well, nothing that bad is going to happen because it is a 13-year-old kid. Like, you know, yeah. Like, it can't be that bad. But, like, this bit's bad, man. Like, you don't want that to happen to you.
You don't want that. And then the tall man lurks up and starts chasing after him.
And what does Michael say when, like, immediately after
this
the death?
This is, like, the sense of humour of the film. That, like, there's this whole thing where, like, you know, like, this guy is there in a puddle of piss with, like, a massive drill hole in his face. And the tall man lurks around a corner at the other end of the corridor. And Michael's like,
oh, shit.
It's very dry. Very dry. I really, really like it.
And so they have a bit of a chase, and the tall man, like, almost catches Michael, but he slams his hand in a door. And when I say slams his hand in the door, I mean the door is closed, but dude's fingers are still, like, just flapping randomly.
You can hear the kind of, they're just kind of, like, slapping around, reaching for something, and it's really creepy. And then Michael's got sock knife, bosh, off come the fingers. And what's the guy made out of? He's made out of, like, butternut squash soup. It's all this, like, yellowy orange, like, gunk.
Yeah. Going.
He's made out of custard. It's like, bleh. And you're like, and then his fingers are on the floor and they're still moving. You're like, oh, well, that's not right.
No, yeah, he's a wrong'un.
Yeah. You don't want that. You want to go and get that thing too. And then, like, Michael grabs a finger and he scarpers off home. And we're just like, yeah, good, like, well done, Phantasm. Thank you.
I mean, excellent stuff. But, like, why would you take the finger? Why would you take a finger
home?
He
takes the finger so that he can show Jodie. And he's got the finger in a little box, and he can hear it rattling away in there. And
because the finger's still alive!
It's still alive. And he gives it to Jodie, and Jodie opens up the box, looks in and goes, yeah, I believe you. Perfect.
So funny.
And then he's like, tell you what we're going to do. We're going to go and see, there's something weird going on up at that cemetery. It's like, excellent deduction, Jodie. We're going to go to the cemetery. Like, you know, go and get the box. Like, the box is up in, because the editing in this film is so weird, where they're, like, having this conversation outside. And then, like, Jodie asks Michael a question. And then we suddenly cut to them indoors continuing the conversation. And it's just kind of like, what happened? What happened between cuts? And then, like, the box was outside and now it's up in Michael's bedroom, and it's just like weird fucking editing. But when Michael goes up to go and get the box with the finger, he opens it up and looks. It's turned into this weird furry piranha fish insect thing.
It's like a house fly, but like...
It makes a buzzing sound, but kind of looks a bit like a spider, but also a bit like an angry fish. And it jumps out and he's like, rah! And he's like, oh, where did that go? And then he's like, you see his hair shuffling, and he's saying, it's in my hair! It's in my hair!
And this is so good.
He, like, wraps it up in a shirt. This is a bit where, like, Michael and Jodie take turns in fighting a shirt.
Yeah, and they're just, like, wrestling with this shirt that's got, like, a giant fly in it. It's like the size of a big avocado, I guess. And it's like making this horrible buzzing, and they're like, oh, you take it. Oh, no, you take it.
Put it in the garbage disposal. We'll blend it up.
And they blend it up in the garbage disposal, and Jodie's like, well, you're ruined my jacket.
and then
Reggie turns up, the ice cream man. He's like, hi, guys, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And they're just like, panting away. And then the fly comes back out of the garbage disposal again. And it's so cartoonish. And, like, everything of the pacing and stuff, it's, as you said, it's, like, really, like, funny, but, like, the right kind of, like, do they know it's funny? And they obviously do, but, like, all the actors really play it straight.
Yeah, no, it totally works for me. And
so then they secondarily managed to like blend up the fly in the sink, and then it's all fine. And then Reggie, the ice cream man, is like, all right, I'm on your side. Let's kill this son of a bitch.
And then, like, Jodie decides, like, right, now it's my turn. I'm going to go up to the spooky mansion and try and kill the tall man. He's got loads of guns. He goes up there and then has a fight with one of the little dressing gown dwarf monsters in the basement of the mortuary.
Yeah, it jumps on his back.
Oh my god, this is fucking amazing bit. Like, it jumps on his back, so it's like he's got this little child in a dressing gown on his back going, rah, 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 and then he's like, oh no, god, I'm gonna get it, oh god, oh, I've got my gun. And he gets his gun out and he just kind of holds it at arm's length from himself and basically aims it at his own head and then aims it slightly away. So it's kind of like I'm pretty sure I won't shoot myself in the head, I'll probably shoot the little goblin thing that's on my back. And it just looks so dumb. Like, it's amazing. It just looks like he's like, I better kill myself. And then he's like, oh, I shot him. Great. And then he's like, well, I better, like, you know, like, disappear and get back off home. Like, oh, it's so good.
Yeah, that's really weird, that bit.
And then he gets attacked by a car.
Gets attacked by a car with no driver, supposedly. Although I think it's actually being driven by one of the dwarves who's just too small for him to see.
Yeah.
And so he's, like, trying, running away, being pursued by this driverless car. And then Michael turns up and he's like, get in, we're gonna be firing guns randomly into the night. And so they're driving, and Jody's like hanging out the sunroof firing a shotgun just like wildly into the town that he lives in.
Yeah. They crash, they blow up the engine of like the other car, it crashes, and then like they can see who was driving the car. It's one of these little goblin monsters, and they take off the hood, and it was their friend Tommy.
He's the guy that got killed right at the start of the film that was boning down in the graveyard.
And he's now 3 feet tall, and they like they get Reggie the ice cream guy, and they put the body of Tommy in the back of the van. And they're like, well, this is weird. Yeah.
And I love, there's this great line. Reggie's like, he's not going to bleed yellow shit all over my ice cream, is he?
He probably does.
And this is, and then they like drive back to Reggie's house, and there's this super weird, inexplicable bit.
Oh my God.
Where there's this old lady in Reggie's house who's just like, are you guys back yet? And Reggie's like, yes, we are, Myrtle. And then it cuts to the next scene. But like, A, you don't explain who Myrtle is. B, obviously that they're back yet. That's how you're having a conversation with them, yeah. Myrtle. You can't say, are you back yet? No, I'm not back yet. I'm also having a psychic conversation with you from miles away.
Also, that is the only time we ever see Myrtle. It's just like, they just introduce this woman just for like a jump scare. It's like, oh, geez, Myrtle. And it's just the way they introduce it. It's like, oh, like we've known her all along. It's just like very, very odd bit of editing.
So then we have like a bit of an exposition party almost where they all start speaking like this crazy jive language.
Yeah.
And they're like, hey, Daddy, what are we going to do about this stone sucker?
You're like, oh, man, I want you to, Ice Cream Man, I want you to hustle Michael on over to Sally and Thingy's house where their antique shop that they live in, and you're going to keep him safe over there, all right? And then we're going to go skibbity-bow. Michael goes over to like this...
It's like an antique store that their friends run or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And while he's there, he picks up an old photograph, which is of the funeral parlour 100 years ago. And the photo in the frame zooms in like a camera shot. And then it's the tall man, and he turns around and he's driving the hearse from back in the day, and he looks straight at Michael while he's holding it. It's kind of a cheesy trick, but it works quite well.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's best if you don't really think about it too much and like what this actually means in context of the film, because it's kind of like, what?
I think it means it's a random thing. Immortal and has been there a very long time.
Yes, that makes sense. That makes sense, but this is literally the only thing that tells us that he is immortal and has been there a long time and has been doing whatever he's been doing for a very long time. In what is a dialogue-free scene. It's just like, you know, this weird thing happens and a look. But it's cool. It's got a kind of Stephen King It kind of vibe, like from the book where there's like, they're always looking into photos and the photos try and get them. Michael's like, oh my God, we got to get out of here. You got to take me back home to Jody, because Jody keeps on sending Michael off places in this film. And literally every time he does, something fucking spooky happens to one of them. It's like, just stay together, guys. But when they're on their way, they find Reggie the ice cream guy's ice cream truck has been overturned.
Yes, because he was driving it with the dwarf in the back.
Yeah, so like dwarf Tommy has obviously broken out. Reggie is gone. And Michael has a bit of a snoop around. He starts freaking out. And he starts saying to the two girls that he's with, like, you gotta go. We gotta start driving. You gotta start driving. Oh my God. And they're like, what? What are you talking about? Where are we going? We gotta go. And then someone starts trying to break into the door. The door handle starts rattling. And they're like, what's that? It's like, oh my God. How much more can I tell you that we need to go? Like, I don't know what's going on. And then suddenly, boom, dwarves, like dressing gown dwarves come. They like, and this is for a very like snappily edited weird film. This bit then suddenly takes eight. They just spend ages of these dwarves throttling these three people in the back of this car, and then they like throw Michael out and they drive off with the girls. So they've kidnapped the girls now.
Yeah, these girls that we haven't really properly met before.
And we will not see again!
Yeah. So Michael legs it back to Jodie's house. Jodie's just been sitting in a chair having a ruddy good think.
Yeah, literally just staring at the ceiling while everyone else without doing shit.
He's like, "Rah, that Reggie's dead. Reggie, the ice cream man, is dead. And the girls are probably dead as well. Oh, no." And so Jodie's like, "Right, I've had enough of this. You're not going to be in any more danger. I'm going to put you in your bedroom and I'm going to lock the door by jamming a screwdriver into the door jamb."
I don't know.
And he's like, "And I'm going to go off and end this once and for all." And Michael is, obviously, this is kind of his greatest fear out of all things, is that Jodie is leaving.
Yeah.
Or something might happen to Jodie. He's lost his parents. He doesn't want to lose his brother. So, you know, he'd rather be facing the fear of the tall man than lose his brother and just sit in his bedroom. That's something he can't bear. So we get this really long extended shot, which in contrast to the last quite extended scene, this works quite nicely, I think.
Yeah.
Of Michael just sort of sitting there being really distraught and then like figuring out how he can escape the bedroom.
Yeah, it's weird.
What does he do, Tom?
So he kind of, you know, is like, he's really agitated and he starts agitatedly fiddling with a shotgun shell, which he just has in his pocket because Jodie has lots of guns. So, you know, 13-year-old boys have some live ammunition in his pocket. It's like, yeah, okay, cool. And then he's like, but wait. And then he just like literally just looks slightly to the right and just like picks up a giant hammer that he also has on his desk in his bedroom. And then he kind of like MacGyver rigs, like he just like tapes this shotgun shell to the end of the hammer and then something else onto it to kind of like help with the like setting it off.
I think it's like a thumbtack or something.
Yeah, and he basically like creates a gun hammer.
Yes, it's a gun hammer!
He just like goes up and fucking hammers the door and it blows a hole through the door and then he just gets out and it's just like, it's a cool bit. I kind of want more gun hammers. I kind of wanted him to like go into battle with the tall man with like a gun hammer and at the end he was going to like gun hammer his head or something. It was going to make his head explode.
It's a pretty cool device. But
then the tall man pops out.
Yeah, this is a really good surprise because you think that Jodie's going off to like showdown with the tall man at the mausoleum. And Michael's got a rush to go help him. He rushes out of the bedroom door. And no, yeah, the tall man's there.
And he's like, again, he's like, "I've been, you know, trying to get you,
boy."
Yeah, he's got it in for him. Ooh, and then we go to the mausoleum and some fucking shit's going to go on.
So there's a bit of a car crash. Michael's in riding in the back of the hearse.
And then he's like, yeah, he's like, "Oh, I'm in the back of the hearse. What have I got? I've got a handgun in my back pocket. That'll be handy." And instead of turning around and like shooting the tall man in the back of the head, he like shoots out the back window of the hearse, like, "Brilliant, I can get out." And he's like, "Wait a minute, I better kill this tall man." Again, does not turn around and shoot the tall man. Instead, shoots out one of the tires through the floor of the car.
Yeah, that's pretty sick. Through the floor of the car he's riding in, he shoots the tires out, jumps out, tall man crashes, and the hearse like explodes in the biggest ball of fire you've ever seen.
Yeah. Oh, it's pretty cool. And he's like, "Right, better go and help Jodie in the mausoleum." Jodie's been snooping around and his parents are in there. And I think he's opened up their parents'
coffin.
Little coffin. Not the coffin, but like the little chamber that holds the coffin. Because they're obviously like their friend Tommy was resurrected and turned into a weird yellow goo dwarf. So they're like, "Well, we better go and see if they've done that to mum and dad." And then there's this moment where where Michael goes and finds the parents' casket, the dad's casket. And it's like, "Hey, Dad, I'm sorry about this." And opens it up and he's not in there. And he freaks the fuck out. And he's like, "No."
Because that means they've been turned into dwarves.
They've been turned into dwarves. But that's the last that we get of that plot thread. We don't ever see the parents.
Well,
which feels like that was going to be a big bit. I was like, man, some dwarves going to pop up and the fucking hood's going to come back and it's going to be the parents and it's going to be this thing where it's like, well, your parents are back from the dead. It's what you've always wanted, but they're not your parents.
They're only 3 feet tall.
Felt like, yeah, exactly. Like at least some of your parents have come back from the dead. Maybe not 2 feet of them. And then like, Yeah, like, I mean, I'm sure that that must be in all that edited out stuff, because it just seems like they, you know, they set it up and it seems like such an, like, an obvious thing to do. You've got, like, this guy's resurrecting people.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, like, and to what end?
And a boy who's, like, obsessed with death and fascinated and terrified by it.
Yeah, exactly. It just, like, yeah, like, that kind of, like, frustrated me. Like, I wonder if, like, you know, it's something they will pick up on.
Maybe in a sequel, later, right?
Because it feels like a juicy, you know, like, little thread to pull on.
You know what else is a juicy thread, though, Tom?
Ooh.
These fucking silver murder balls.
Yeah.
Because one of the murder balls turns up when Jodie and Michael are, like, reunited, and they have this quite tender moment. Admittedly, they don't wring all that parent juice out, but there is a nice moment between them where he's like, I'm sorry I looked in the coffin. I looked in it. I shouldn't have looked in it, but it's empty. But then the silver floating murder ball is there and it's coming at them, and we see, like, murder ball vision, and everything's red and black like the Predator.
It's cool.
Super cool. And it's coming for them. And at this point, like, honestly, they've established these balls are so brutal. It's scarier than the Tall Man, and he's pretty scary. And I'm like, one of them's going to die. I mean, probably Jodie, admittedly. Like, maybe not Michael.
Yeah.
But, like, he's going to get messed up. But then, no, Jodie shotguns the ball and it explodes in midair. It's pretty banging.
It's pretty banging. And then they're like, right, there's this spooky door we've got to go to. We'll go find the spooky door. It's like, yep, okay, cool. They spend a minute creeping along. And they go, yeah, this is the door. And they go in. And
Before they go in,
Reggie's back. Reggie, yeah, the ice cream man.
Remember when he died in that car crash?
Yeah. And, like, he pops up in what just has to be, like, a bit of, like, an additional photography where he just kind of, like, pops up and goes, like, oh, hey, guys. Oh, yeah, it was really crazy. I've just been hiding in a coffin for a while, and then I got out, and then I found those two girls and a bunch of other girls I've never even seen before, and then they all ran out the window, so they're all fine. So let's
don't need to worry about them no more.
So let's not worry about that plot thread anymore. That's with another, you know, like, hour and a half's worth of stuff that we don't need to think about. Don't think about your parents either. Shall we go in the spooky door? And then they go in the spooky door, and then shit gets really weird.
like, once they're in the spooky door, I'm so sold on inside the spooky door. This whole scene is absolutely incredible. So it's a pure white room where the walls, floor and ceiling aren't just white, they're glowing with light. But it's full of these black barrels that are stacked up, and they're terrifying, these barrels. They're like kind of funeral urns.
Yeah.
They're also like beer kegs. It's kind of weird. What's inside the barrels is the dwarves. They're barrels full of dwarves.
Yeah. Like the Tall Man is amassing an army of dwarves.
An army of dwarves
for some reason.
Storing them in barrels. And then as they enter, the music really swells. And I don't know if any of our listeners are familiar with the band Sun, sometimes called Sun O, this sort of avant-garde metal band, which is all just about playing one note really loudly and letting it resonate. This is what the music does in 1979.
Gee. Dwarves.
And it just goes on and on and on and on, and it's so loud, and it's so intense, and it's so good, Tom.
God, Reggie, look at this.
And then they turn around, and they look, and at the far corner of the white room, there's just these two silver spikes, like the kinds that are on the murder balls. And Jodie and Reggie the Ice Cream Man, they're like busy fussing around looking with the barrels, looking in the little windows and being like, hey, there's dwarves in here. We're not actually going to show you them, but like, there's dwarves in here. That's weird. He's collecting them. He's amassing an army. Everybody that, quick bit of exposition, everybody that dies, he puts them in one of these barrels and they shrink down and turn into a dwarf, I guess. Okay, that sucks. While Michael's moving towards these two sort of silver forks, and he reaches out and he reaches in between them, and his hand disappears. It's like a portal to another dimension. It's like Stargate or something.
Yeah.
And then he flashes back to when he was doing that scene from June with the spooky granny. And she's like, you have to put your hand in the thing.
Don't be afraid.
Don't be afraid. Because fear is the killer. Not the mind killer, because that's copyright. It's just the killer. Like, this is worse.
It's a legally distinct killer.
It's the physical killer of like everything else. And he's like, all right, then I'm going to jump in. And he jumps in between. And he falls into this like field of red smoke, and then he's looking down at this like desert planet, Tom. Some sort of strange desert planet.
Some sort of Dune-esque planet. Bright red sky, like a trail of dwarves all kind of like walking in like a procession, and he's like floating slash falling in the air, and he's like, whoa, 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 what's going on? It's all very Dune. And then like someone like Jodie's hand reaches through the portal and grabs his butt and like pulls him out, and he just comes out and quickly goes, it's a planet, the dwarves are slaves, and they're compressed by the gravity. Okay, we've explained that. Moving on.
Well, that's all the explanation that's you're going to get.
That's it. They're aliens, I guess. But also, let's not talk about it ever again in the film.
Although, let's you and me talk about this just now. Because if it is what I understand it to be, it's quite an interesting concept. So I'm pretty sure the Tall Man is an alien.
Yeah.
He has been sent to our planet through this dimensional gate by people like him, aliens like him. And his job is to kill people or collect people that have died,
yeah,
and then like send them back through to be slaves where they are shrunk down by do they shrink down upon arrival at the alien planet?
Well,
or does he shrink them down in advance?
No, well, Michael intuits very quickly that it is the gravity on the planet is much stronger, so I guess it's compressing them down.
Compressing them down.
I guess a bit like in The Expanse, where instead of people living in like really heavy gravity, they get short. People living in lighter gravity, their bodies elongate and get really weird. It's like kind of like that, but like, you know, more like Dune.
I suppose. But I do love the idea of the Tall Man being an alien.
I mean, it's very cool. It's like, it's a fucking batshit bonkers crazy twist. And like I was saying, like, why if I had to wait 9 years to find out more about this, I want to know what the fuck is going on here. And I, you know, like, films do not always need to answer everything, but this film throws up some fucking weird shit. And like, it's kind of cool and baller that it is just kind of like so out there and weird with no explanation. But I, you know, like, I want something. I want to know more. Like, the, like, it's very like the world building that is going on here is, it's a tease.
It's a real tease.
And then so like they get him out, they get Michael out, he says his bit of exposition, Jodie turns, goes, I just put my hand in the thing and it disappeared, and then all the lights go out.
This is a masterful like decision, I think, at this point, where you're reeling and you're so used to this like overload. You've been in this bright white room, the music is so loud, you know, we've had flashes of this colourful alien planet, and they're like, yeah, it's this, they're slaves, it's the gravity, the Tall Man's an alien, it's all happening, oh my god, what are we going to do? And then all of the lights go out.
Yeah.
And everything's quiet, and like suddenly you've got no stimulus at all.
And then suddenly, Michael and Jodie are both outside.
Because the Tall Man was there, I think. I think that's the implication. Yeah. Like, the lights go out, the Tall Man's there.
It's hard to tell because the lights have gone out. But they're outside now, and then the lights go back up, and it's just Reggie, the ice cream man, on his own. And then it all comes back to that scene where they were jamming on the porch, where he tuned his guitar using a tuning fork, and there's the two little forks on the portal, and he's like, it's like a tuning fork, and I need to put my fingers on the end of these things because like a tuning fork. Yeah. And he does it, and when he does it, it makes the booby stabby lady, she appears and tries to kill Michael, that she suddenly has to stop doing that because he's touching the tuning fork, and then everything gets windy. Everything gets incredibly windy.
Really windy. Too windy.
Yeah, definitely too windy. And it's then Reggie gets outside and he gets stabbed by the boob lady. And
that's sad. I was really sad to see him die.
Yeah. And then
The house like disappears in a big hologram.
Yes, it just suddenly goes. What? It's gone. It, but like, not Amityville even, horror, like, disappears. Yeah,
but not even, like, in a kind of a drawn-out, like, kaboom, like, I'm disappearing now, goodbye. There's this, like, really quick shot where it just flashes, like, every colour of the rainbow. It just goes, and it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah, but this film is not over. This ride is not over because the Tall Man is still out there because Reggie got stabbed.
He was in the body of the sexy girl that was stabbing Reggie, so he wasn't in the house when it disappeared.
Yeah.
So now Michael and Jodie are like back at their crib, and they're like, what are we going to do about the man? And he's like, oh, there's a mine shaft. There's this abandoned mine shaft. We're going to chuck him down there. Reggie's going to be the last dead body that he'll turn into a shrunken dwarf.
Yeah.
And so they, like, tempt him out?
Well, Jody goes up to, like, set up a booby trap at this mine shaft, and then, and in classic Jody fashion, says, Michael, you just hang out at home. I'm pretty sure that the tall man won't try and come and murder you. Obviously he does. And then chases Michael all the way up the hill, up to the mine shaft. Michael jumps over like this very like Swiss Family Robinson style trap that they've laid, where they've like laid some reeds over the big hole, and then the tall man doesn't see it and he falls into a big hole. Jody pushes loads of boulders in. The tall man has fallen down this 1,000-foot like mine shaft. Brilliant, everything's great. And then Michael wakes up and you're like, hang about. And then Michael is sat by a roaring romantic fire, cuddling with Reggie the ice cream man, who's like, you just had a bad dream, man. The tall man, like,
he doesn't exist.
It's all been a dream, and Jody is dead from dying in a car crash.
Yeah.
And he's like, no, like, you know, don't worry. Like, the tall man didn't take Jody away. It was a car crash. Why don't we just go on a trip? I'll look after you from now on. I'll be your family. And you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. So Reggie's alive. He's having this very sensual cuddle behind the fireplace with the 13-year-old boy. Jody's dead. They're not seriously doing a, it was all a dream.
They kind of are and they kind of aren't, because they get so excited to go leave in the middle of the night for their road trip. Michael goes upstairs to like pack his shit and the tall man's there.
Yeah.
And the tall man's there and it's a really cool shot. He goes, boy! And then like some kind of gorilla hands that I guess are dwarf hands burst out of the mirror and like grab him in and pull him.
And that's the end of the film. It's a very Friday the 13th part one ending.
Yes.
where you have the kind of like, everything is resolved and then they can't quite help but do a fake out jump scare thing at the end that then completely throws your understanding of what you've just watched. Because that's kind of how I feel like the first Friday film is, where it's kind of like, okay, everything's good, everything's cool. And there's like, zombie. And you're like, wait, what? Credits. And that's what this is like, where it just goes, it was a dream? And then...
Yeah, so was it a dream or was it not?
Well, I guess we're going to find out in the next film, because, I mean, like, is Michael going to actually be back in there? Because it's got to be, if we're going to have, like, a recurring thread through all these films, I assume it's going to be Michael rather than Jody, so maybe...
Well, I can tell you that the tall man is definitely in it.
Maybe he'll wake up again at the beginning and go, oh, that was all another dream or yeah. something. Like.
Well, because no matter what, 9 years will have passed in the real world of filming, right? It's nine years later. Yeah. So even if they have Michael, and I'm really hoping they do.
He's good. I like him.
He will now be 22.
Yeah.
At the time of filming. So like his life will have changed a fair amount.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of questions. A lot of questions have been thrown up by this film, but all I can say at this point is I am in. I want to see where this crazy train goes.
And where would you like it to go, Tom?
I don't know. Like, I kind of want to see a bit more. Like, I don't want to necessarily say everything. I just want a little bit more of, like, the alien Dune planet.
That's what I want. Yeah, that's what I want, too.
I want a little bit more of kind of, like, what the tall man is, what he's doing. They can still bring the parents into it. Like, we still don't know what's going on with them. Is that planet Zeist?
Oh, my God. That would be the ultimate planet. If it's planet Zeist, my head will explode.
This thing has been blown wide open. So, yeah, like, I just kind of want, like, a little bit, like, you know, it seems like there's something cool. There's a cool mythology under this that they're not telling us. And I think it's a very, you know, cool, ballsy first movie tease to just be like, oh yeah, there's an alien planet in it for about 30 seconds. What are you going to do about it? I want a little bit more.
Yeah, and that's what I want.
Some more flying silver balls. I want to know what the deal is with the flying silver balls. Like, what? Why? I mean,
because they're fucking banging.
They are cool.
Yeah. That's why. Apparently, I read that the whole idea for the movie started with the balls. That was a nightmare that Don Coscarelli had of being pursued by one of those balls.
It's a cool jump-off point, especially as it like is not in the films very much. But as it comes in your box set, I imagine they're going to play a prominent part in the next four films.
I hope so.
Hopefully, we're in for a treat. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what happens in the next one.
Yeah. So, looking forward to coming in next time for Phantasm 2, an 80s beast.
Mm-hmm.
So, listeners, we hope you've enjoyed us rambling on about Phantasm. If you've seen it and you love it, then let us know what you think. If you've seen it and you didn't love it quite so much, then let us know what your bloody problem is, you weirdo. And if you haven't seen it, maybe check it out, or otherwise don't, because we'll be watching the next one, so you don't have to.
Yeah.
You can drop us a line on Twitter at BitterEndPod, or reach us on Facebook at BitterEndPod.
Well, until next time, I'm Tom Denny.
I'm Todd Jordan.
And I don't think this is all a dream.